Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee from the Scene Stealers podcast, and I'm here, as usual, with Trey Hawk and Eric Moline.
What's up?
Hey, dude.
Hi.
That's what the kids say now.
Sorry, I missed last week.
It's all right.
Trey's here to take us to task.
Yeah.
Because we reviewed the Avengers without him.
Yeah, we took the opportunity.
A scheduling conflict. And we just thought that he was avoiding the backlash because he knew that we were on one side of the film and the other, and I thought he cowardly was slinking away into the sunset, but he's back with a vengeance this week.
I am an Avenger.
There you go. Yeah. He's going to avenge
his honor.
All non fans of that film.
You and A.O. Scott.
Yep. And so you guys are going to have to wait. You, the viewing, listening audience. I don't know what you're viewing right now. I hope it's a picture of Trey.
Whenever I don't listen to the podcast very often, but whenever I do, I actually just look at pictures of us while it's on.
That's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
You know. But Trey's going to talk about the Avengers with us at the end of this podcast. What are we going to talk about first and second, Trevin?
Trevin?
Trey Trevin?
Trey Trevin?
Trayvon?
Uh-oh. We're going to talk about a couple movies. You're going to tell me all about... Actually, you're going to tell us both because we can take Trey out of the isolation chamber. You're going to tell us about The Dictator.
Yes.
Sacha Baron Cohen's new comedy. And then I'm going to tell you about Battleship.
Fantastic. What would you like to start with?
The movie based on a board game directed by Peter Berg, the guy who did Friday Night Lights. Let's start with The Dictator because I get the feeling that Battleship will segue nicely into the Avengers counterpoint.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, so I'm going to start this review with a little bias so that everybody knows where I'm coming from here. I was a big fan of the Ali G show.
Mm-hmm. Because it was fucking hilarious.
Before it was even on HBO, my friend Cliff would send VHS tapes of the British version of the show, and we would watch them in the van in my old band, and we would laugh hilariously at Sacha Baron Cohen and his characters Borat Bruno and Ali G. And the crazy reality-based prank humor and how right on some of his satire really was. Yeah. So when Borat came to America, and that was a big hit in the theaters, I was 100% behind it. And I think that Borat got all the attention that it deserved that year. Now, that said, I think Borat is due for an overlooked movie written by me, which will happen soon, because the reviews I've read of The Dictator since writing my review and seeing what everybody else thought were almost universally slamming Bruno and saying that Borat was this big high point and then Bruno was this big letdown. Now, box office wise, it certainly was.
So hold on. You want to do an overlooked movie for Bruno or Borat?
Yeah, for Bruno.
Okay.
Bruno is a fucking amazing movie.
Yeah.
I'm using the F word there.
That's
how much I like that movie.
I see that, yeah.
I bought it on Blu-ray. Yeah. There's no reason to buy a movie that was filmed on a flip cam on Blu-ray, right? Essentially a flip cam. The most amazing thing about Bruno, though, is the commentary and listening for the first time since they're done, Larry Charles, the director who did those two movies in The Dictator, and Sacha Baron Cohen, since they're done with reality-based humor now, and they're not going to try to make another movie like that, they let everybody in on all their secrets on how they filmed all of those sequences, which is something they didn't do after Borat.
Yeah.
And the stories are crazy. The commentary is longer than the movie itself. So when they get to – they want to tell a story and the movie's moving on too quickly, they pause it.
Mm-hmm.
And they finish their story, and then they start the movie up
again. So the film will literally pause in the commentary?
The commentary is longer than the movie.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
And the stories, if you even know how movies are made at all, if you're even casually interested in it, the stories on the Borat commentary disc are absolutely amazing. This guy This guy was in danger a lot. Mm-hmm. And the ways that they knew that people would react, they had things scripted out because he was pushing buttons. He knew that people were going to go a certain way, and they didn't always. But anyway, so my bias is I think Bruno was a really right-on satire, and I think a lot of the reason that people reacted negatively to it was because he pushed the shock factor and because the character was homosexual and pushing it in your face the whole time.
There is a talking penis.
There is a talking penis, yeah.
Which is one of my favorite jokes in the entire movie.
There is some insane stuff in that film, but I think... And okay, so now we're going to go to the Dictator. The Dictator is his...
To put this in perspective, you know, because there was an Ali G movie that no one likes to talk about because it was really bad.
Yes.
And it was really bad because it strayed from that reality-based humor that both Borat and Bruno use. So that was my trepidation with The Dictator, was knowing that it was an entirely fictional and intentionally fictional movie that didn't exist in reality in any way.
Yep.
So my question before you get started is it able to actually use that sort of tried and true setup, you know, and succeed as a completely fictional movie?
Succeed on what level? This movie's not perfect.
Right.
It is uneven as hell. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge chasm, if I may use that word, between the style of humor that they're using and the style of movie that they've tried to push it into, right? It's like... Americans are used to our modern romantic American comedies where things happen a certain way for a certain reason, and they feel comfortable because we know that this couple's going to this oddball couple will get together and then break apart and get together at the end.
Right.
That is what The Dictator is. Who knew? The Dictator was a romantic comedy. They haven't been selling it that way at all. But basically, it's also like Airplane. It's like the Zucker Brothers movies where... it knows it's a gag-based film, and it has about 80 minutes to squeeze in as many jokes as possible, hoping that many of those jokes will land, and knowing that the audience will probably not laugh at least a third of them. So it's just constantly moving from one joke to the next, and it's a combination of shock humor. And honestly, the whole idea of it is satire. But the satire doesn't always come across because the humor is just so shocking. You're not really thinking about why you're laughing at it. You just know it's wrong.
So is it more or less shocking than some of the more shocking scenes in Bruno?
Well, here's the thing. When I saw Bruno, I felt the same way as when I saw this movie.
Okay.
I was and Borat, for that matter, the scene where the two guys are running around naked
in
the hotel.
You thought I'm going to buy this on Blu-ray when it comes out?
No, I didn't think either of that for either of those movies. I was just too busy, like, you know... It's crazy because I consider myself to be a pretty hard person to shock, but during The Dictator, there were at least two scenes where I had my hands up over in front of my face, not wanting to look at the screen. And I think if I'm doing that with a smile on my face and I'm laughing, that's something I want to see again. That's the really weird part. But so bottom line, Aladdin is this dictator. Yes, it's a fictional film. He comes to New York. Mm-hmm. And he's going to deliver this speech, and Ben Kingsley is the guy who's next in line or who wants the power or whatever.
Right.
And basically he kidnaps Aladdin and puts a body double in his place, a lookalike in his place. So we're looking at kind of a Dave type thing here.
Okay.
Except that Dave's not kidnapped. Aladdin gets out of the kidnapping in a ridiculous fashion, and a really funny scene with John C. Reilly, who's only in the movie for two scenes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And by the way, there are celebrity cameos throughout this film.
Mm-hmm.
The people in this movie that they got to do these cameos must have the best sense of humor about themselves ever, because the things that they are made to do on screen are not on screen, but that are intuited from that, right? Like Edward Norton walks out of a bathroom after a guy, and you're just like, wow, these guys really must have a sense of humor.
Yeah, because I mean, the Megan Fox scene is in the
preview
trailer.
Yeah, and she's basically a high priced hooker,
right?
But she refuses. Right. She draws the line at an all night cuddle.
Oh, yeah.
He wants to cuddle all night, and she's like, nope, I'm out of here. And then the camera pulls back to reveal a wall of celebrities that have slept with him. And it starts with Lindsay Lohan, and it ends with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's very, very nice. Funny. So, but there's tons of stuff like that just laced throughout the film. I don't know where I was going, but basically he meets Anna Faris.
Mm-hmm.
She's a greengrocer. She's got hair in her armpits. She's got short hair, peace-loving, you know, hippie, whatever.
Sure,
the last person in love he'd fall in – or last person he's supposed to fall in love with. And he does, and it's dumb. And you don't believe it. Like, if anybody walks out of this movie and they go, oh, the characters weren't good, you know, again, don't use a fucking checklist when you're reviewing a movie, you know?
Right.
This movie's not going for realism. It's mm-hmm. it's completely subversive and completely over the top and absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happens in it. I mean, there's a scene where one of his body doubles gets shot in the head. Okay? He uh-huh. gets shot in the head and survives because he says, well, how are you still alive? And he says, well, this is what I live for. I'm just doing my job. So he's okay. He's uh-huh. okay because he got shot in the head. But sure. that's what his job was. And so,
right.
you know, he yeah. did his job. He's not going to die. He just got shot in the head. Anyway, yes, it's uneven.
I actually really like that joke.
Yeah, and it may not be your cup of tea. And I think that listening to my review right now, you'll know whether or not you want to see this film. I was pleasantly surprised at how much it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a lot of uncomfortable scenes that don't work. And I don't think that Larry Charles has... the director. I don't think he has a great shooting or editing style that really befits this kind of comedy, which is weird yet. But I don't think he's ready. He was ready really to take on a fully fictional narrative film
because yeah.
there's no visual style. Well, it's just kind of a
it's
mess.
It's a totally different sensibility.
Yeah.
You'd have to build a film like Bruno or Borat like you build a documentary.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, because you're just going to shoot and hopefully you get
right.
something and
exactly.
then you'll make the story in the back end.
Right.
And so it's a totally different approach.
This one still kind of feels like that. I mean, there are some scenes with, you know, some nice camera shots and stuff mm. like that. But and here's the thing. Then again, who cares?
This is not a film that you go to for, like, incredibly composed
yeah.
camera
right.
shots.
Yeah, I'm not looking for, you know,
yeah.
Emmanuel Uzbeki or Roger Deakins here. I just want a laugh.
Right.
And this movie 100% supplies the laughs. When I went back and started thinking about
mm-hmm.
Its weaknesses, there are many, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, at any given moment, a plot line will come up and then be completely...
Did Cohen write the script?
He co-wrote it with three other guys.
Okay.
Yeah. But here's the thing, and here's the last part. I'm going to end this because it's kind of a duh review, right? If
right.
you liked it or you didn't. Sacha Baron Cohen is a unique, talented comic genius in his own right. There's nobody like him right now, and that's the best thing I can say about this movie, is that there's a ton of comedies out there that have very similar voices. When you go see one of his films, it's a very distinct voice. And the dictator tries to one-up Bruno in a lot of departments and Borat. And I think the fact that he's pushing himself instead of selling out. I thought this movie might be a little bit more bland like you were thinking.
Right.
Because he's going with the fictional thing. I admire the fact that he's still pushing the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still just smashing the halls of bad taste. I mean, it's... yeah. Anyway... go see this with a big crowd if you like that kind of stuff, because part of the fun is listening to other people howl and
get uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Get uncomfortable and scream no.
Yeah, I saw Borat with like eight other people, and it was just one of the best times I've had in a movie theater. Just that sort of gang mentality when you're watching a comedy.
Now, that said, I only gave this movie a minor rock fist up.
That's kind of what I expected.
Which is crazy. Now, because when I tell people about it, I want everybody to go see it. So I'm wondering if I was too harsh on it with the checklist idea by saying, oh, well, there's all these technical things wrong with it. And maybe if I should have just gone with a solid rock fist up because it succeeds most of the time where it wants to. But a movie that if all of its jokes would have landed, that would be insane.
But at the same time, it's like we've all had the discussion of the... you know, sort of inherent embraced inadequacies of
yeah.
a rating system anyway.
Yeah, right.
And I, to me, it's just there's a level of honesty that, you know, of saying, no, there's some real problems with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's some places where it definitely fails on the terms that it sets for itself. I mean, if it's trying to be a romantic comedy and it fails in that, then that's a failure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if the jokes and the shock humor and the stuff that it really is continuing to strive for totally hit.
For anybody that's seen the film since this opened 2 days ago,
right?
You'll know what I'm talking about, but the scene where the dictator and the green grocer finally hold hands
mm-hmm.
may be the single most disturbing thing I've seen.
Nice.
And I can't, once you see it, you cannot unsee it.
And you've seen Blue Velvet like 20 times.
I've seen Blue Velvet a lot.
Yeah. You've seen Irreversible.
Yeah.
I have seen, you know, let's not get into that.
that movie just sits in my Netflix instant queue and I look at it and I just, I'm like, one of these days.
Yeah.
I'm going to fucking do it. Like, one of these days.
That's going to be the review I write for Overlooked Movie Death Day.
Yeah, I'm just going to sit down with a bottle of Jameson and a tumbler and be like, all right.
I wouldn't do that. I mean, I think you've got to go in clear-headed. So, anyway. All
right. Anyway, yeah, so The Dictator, minor rock fist up, maybe more just because it's been a week since I've seen it, and I'm still thinking about it and laughing about it. And that, goddammit, that's another thing you can't say about too many comedies. So I'm defending this movie because I know that it's not going to do as well, and people are going to say the same thing about it that they said about Bruno. So anyway, whatever.
All right, so on to Battleship.
Yeah.
On to Battleship. We go from...
I am super excited about this review.
Freaked out holding hands scene and a Monica Bellucci rape reference to Battleship.
Irreversible.
Yeah, I know, but nobody said anything about rape.
I mean, I talked about Irreversible.
Yeah. So you're just assuming rape?
Yeah, of course.
Well, they're actually quite close together. There's a lot of people taking Sacha Baron Cohen to task for all the rape jokes in The Dictator, saying rape's not funny. That's kind of beside the point.
Right.
He's making fun of a certain attitude where rape is accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not rape jokes because we think rape is funny. Oh, I hate stupid people.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Really in.
Battleship, something that will rape our sensibilities.
There you go.
Yeah, nice secondary segue. You know, it's difficult to really walk into a movie that's based on a board game. That's biggest like accolade on its poster is from Hasbro, the company that brought you Transformers,
and they're about to bring you a lot more movies.
Game of Life and Monopoly. Monopoly, directed by Ridley Scott. It's difficult.
I wish you were joking.
I know.
It's difficult to walk into a movie like that and go in with, you know, like tempered expectations, especially after a trailer that just, you know, screams Michael Bay and, you know, poor Peter Berg, the director. Yeah, poor Peter Berg, whatever. But he's had to kind of suffer some Transformers comparisons for a while now, ever since the first trailer broke. But the thing is, after watching Battleship, they're totally warranted. You know, we'll get into this later, but if Avengers is a nice like sort of take on what Michael Bay does with summer blockbusters, Battleship is like a line for line checklist. Like it is a laundry list of everything you can expect or you saw in the previous three Hasbro movies, the Transformers films. You've got the slow-mo pans and the patriotic, like just the ball swinging truck nut patriotism that just runs through the whole thing. Like that's going on. You got an unlikely hero that doesn't know what the fuck he's doing for pretty much the entire movie,
but then ends up like,
but it saves the day and is like, yes, nice. Go America. You've got an enemy
in love with Liam Neeson's daughter, and Liam Neeson doesn't respect him, and he learns to respect him.
Totally.
I can tell that from the preview.
Oh yeah, that totally happens. And then you've got an enemy that is completely generic and unexplained, and it makes it really easy to kill them because who gives a shit?
Right.
Because they aren't developed enough to care about.
Right.
Them.
Yeah. So it's fine. They're just a disposable, you know, resource that you can just shoot CG bullets at and cheer for them when they explode. It is. I mean, Berg's an odd director to talk about because you know he started out as an actor. He was crucial in developing the television show Friday Night Lights. It's his fault.
He directed the movie.
And then he produced the series, and he directed a few episodes of the series. But he had a controlling hand in every season of that show. And it's his fault that we know who Taylor Kitsch is, because that show broke Taylor Kitsch. And
I like John Carter.
I did too, but I'm just saying, like, we know who Taylor Kitsch is because of Peter Berg.
I think the word you used was fault, and that was a negative.
Taylor
Kitsch sucked in John Carter. Well, like it or not, Taylor.
Yeah,
Kitsch
I guess
was,
you're right. He was the weakest part of that movie.
I think there are a lot of weak points in that film, but Taylor Kitsch, the weakest.
Anyway, it's difficult to talk about the movie in any legitimate fashion. Here's the plot. Okay, Taylor Kitsch's character His last name is Hopper. I can't remember his first name. It's like John or something Hopper.
Let's just call him Kitch Hopper.
His name is Kitch Hopper. Well, he has a brother who's got his shit together, played by Alexander Skarsgård, whose name, and I love this name. I hope if someone out there would send me an action figure, if such a thing exists, I would love them forever. But his brother's name is Stone Hopper.
Nice. Wow. Yeah.
So Stone has his shit together, and he's in the Navy.
He skips around the
and
ship.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm.
So yeah. After one particularly, you know, crazy night, which is actually pretty funny. The beginning of the movie has some pretty funny physical humor where Kitch's character is trying to impress Brooklyn Decker, who Peter Berg really like. He with a Michael Bay level of intensity, he likes to shoot Brooklyn Decker.
Like Megan Fox?
Yeah, like Megan Fox. Nice. He likes to shoot her in short shorts. He likes to shoot her in little white tank tops. He likes to frame her boobs. He's just...
Lens flare out her face.
He loves to shoot her. And the only thing this is an aside, but the only thing he loves to shoot more than her in this movie are guns. He loves... Like I remember a director's commentary for Predator, which is one of my favorite action movies ever. John McTiernan talks about how it's like gun porn. Like he actually says that. And if you look at how the guns are shot in Predator, like when he reveals the minigun, when Jesse Ventura pulls the sheet off and you see the minigun and it pans down. I mean, guns are kind of phallic in general, but man, like McTiernan really framed his guns. This would make McTiernan go, really, dude? Like you. Let's back it off a minute. Like that is one of the biggest standouts. He loves shooting Brooklyn Decker, either sweaty or, you know, in something form fitting. And then he loves to like do long tracking, long wide angle tracking pans down gun barrels. And
it seems like this is an experiment for him, just to try to make this kind of movie.
Yeah, right? You know, I guess. I mean, his next movie in the pipe is Hancock 2. Because I was thinking like if he does this movie. Maybe it's so that he can kind of turn around. I mean, it's not the same thing, but kind of what Terry Gilliam does,
right.
Where he does, you know, like Brothers Grimm, and then turns around and does the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus next. You know, like I kind of thought maybe it would be some sort of, I'll get this big budget movie out of the way, and then I'll get a little more freedom to do something I want to do. But I looked at his IMDb page when I was writing the review, and all of his movies moving forward are kind of this ilk. So I don't know if this is just what he's going to do from now on, but... The movie just centers around Kitch having a crazy night, which is a pretty funny scene, what happens. There's some pretty funny physical comedy during that. And then the next day, his brother's like, you got to get your shit together. You're joining the Navy. And then it flashes forward to him in the Navy. And there's a big naval exercise, kind of like Top Gun. I don't know if it's a real thing, but it's called RIMPAC. RIMPAC. And it's a giant international naval exercise where it's a war game with a bunch of different countries' naval fleets. So Japan comes over and, you know, I can't remember who else, Australia, but there are a bunch of naval fleets and they just all kind of come over. And during their exercise, these aliens come to Earth and they happen to land conveniently. Right next to all these ships in the Atlantic, and
right next to these battleships.
All of these battleships. Thankfully, this is the one thing they didn't do. No one ever says you sank my battleship, and I was expecting.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard. You should at least have that in the film. If you're going to make a cheesy ass battleship movie, you should have that line.
And
in
here's
the
thing:
people at least play battleship in the movie? Are they like F-18?
No, I'll get to that. But there are other ways that they tie it back to the game.
Uh-huh. I was expecting this to be like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is detailed.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's not a lot to it, but it's exactly what you would expect in a lot of ways. Berg makes some weird choices, though. I mean, not weird in, like, why did he do that? But, you know, he goes big budget and does this Michael Bay thing. And I'll say this, like, it's shorter and it's got a tighter edit. And the script is better in the sense that it doesn't have like all these audience insulting fake out scenes like Transformers 3 did, or you know, it doesn't have any of that kind of stuff. I did walk out of it without feeling like exhausted or sensory overloaded.
So
like,
it's better than Transformers 3.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice.
Yeah, but again, like it follows that Bay formula, like the way he frames women,
sure.
The way he shoots the guns, the slow mo. There's a huge patriotic scene at the end, but it's interesting because he casts real Korean war vet, and for one scene that's pretty important, he pulls he uses footage and an actual wounded vet from I don't know, it doesn't say which theater of war we're in right now, but he uses like actual vets for a lot of scenes, and there's a secondary character for most of the movie who's actually like an amputee, a double amputee, mm-hmm. That is an actual vet that's just in the movie. So it's weird that he goes back. He does intentional things to go back to stuff like that, but then in the next scene there are like disjointed alien scenes and nothing's ever really explained. The script doesn't really work overall. There's some really dumb things that just don't add up or make sense. You've got a hero's journey that's really expected, you know, exactly what's going to happen. He's an unlikely leader, and he gets kind of thrust into the, you know, like the captain's killed, so he has to become the captain of the ship, and he starts out and he almost gets them all killed, and then he dials it back and he learns some lessons and learns humility and, you know, saves the day. Like, there's that kind of stuff, you know, that's to be expected. One of the funniest things about it is, to go back to what we were saying, or what I was saying earlier about how it tries to tie itself into the board game. There are two big things that it does to tie itself into the board game that are kind of hilarious. The first is that all the aliens, their ships, when they fire on their enemies, first of all, they only fire when provoked. And I'll get into that in a second. But then the other thing is,
that sounds like a detail that is a plot-based detail. So
no,
like, hey, let's all just stop shooting.
It's weird because it's not really explained like that. I'll get to that. But anyway, their munitions look like the pegs from the board game. And so when they hit the ship, they look like the little pegs, and then they drop down and explode. So like they actually fire the battleship pegs at each other. So that was funny. And then later on, they're flying blind because there's an EMP and we can't see, and well, I don't know what's going on. And so what they come up with is the Japanese captain is like, let's use all of the tsunami buoys because anytime there's a big wake, it sets off one of these buoys. So we can track their movement based on the readings these buoys are giving. And what does that create? A black and green grid, just like Battleship. And so they call out specific locations on the map,
yes,
and attack spots on the map. Like, it's hilarious how much sincerity they treat that. But
yeah,
like they're just, it's clear. It's like 10 grown men and Rihanna staring at a giant battleship board yelling like G8.
Did people start laughing?
No.
What?
In the theater. This is sad. You know what got the biggest laugh, and it kind of made me mad. But you know, I think it says more to Berg's style and everything than what the audience did. But what got the biggest laugh, and then it turned into applause, is there's this scene towards the end. You know, it's called Battleship. Battleships are decommissioned in real life, like the USS Missouri, all the big battleships, like the Reagan, all of those, they've been decommissioned. We use these new ships called destroyers. Now, this is true. Destroyers are more mobile. They can't take a pounding like battleships can, but they're powerhouses. I mean, they've got munitions out the ass. And so this whole movie, like, they're on destroyer ships and running around. Well, they managed to thwart one of the final alien ships, but in the process, like, it gets one last shot off, and it's this little spinny ball of death that just rips the ship in half. Like, it literally cuts it in half and then saws it into a third. It just decimates it. So they need a ship because they've got to get to some control tower and blow it up. And so they go to the USS Missouri in Oahu, and Taylor Kitsch gives this impassioned speech to Korean vets, to the Korean war vets, and says, you guys have already given so much for your country. I'm asking for your help. Help us get this battleship running. And so they break the anchors and they fire up this like old battleship, steam powered battleship. and then it's all to Thunderstruck, AC/DC.
Oh,
so they're just building up, and you've got all these salty old guys that are like, I'll show you how the munitions work. And
right,
you want to cover your ears because the engine's going to be loud and all that. And then so they take an actual battleship out for the final conflict. And it's pretty off the wall. But the biggest laugh comes from, and this was sad, but the biggest laugh came from when he asks the Korean war vets if they'll help him out. There's a slow-mo shot of all of the old guys walking across the top of the battleship, like towards the
like
command
Con Air
center.
In
yeah,
slow-mo.
Like Con Air, or like that scene in Armageddon when they're all in a
Armageddon,
row.
Armageddon, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, like the scene in Armageddon, all that. They're walking towards it, and Thunderstruck starts playing. And the audience thought that was, first they laughed, and I was like, I mean, come on, like, they're actual vets. And then and then people started applauding, and,
yes.
And but yeah, it was, that's like, I, that probably gave Michael Bay a red, white, and blue boner. anyway, the movie's totally forgettable. There's nothing memorable about it. There's giant plot holes. It manages to be slightly entertaining at times, and the humor doesn't. The humor works when there is some, but there usually isn't. One of the best things that it does, like, Berg really just likes to film guns going off. And when the battleship unloads, there's a scene where they just lay into it right before it happens. They do the joke earlier, so it's not as good, but it's all tense and they're getting ready to fire, and it's the strategic maneuver. And then it cuts to this old guy in the weapons building. Goes, let's drop some lead on these mother. And then they just open fire and blow everything up, and everyone goes crazy. And that was like just the biggest dumb payoff of the entire movie. So it gets a minor rock fist down. I mean, it would go major, but it doesn't, like, there are some scenes that work, and the fact that it just wasn't totally, you know, sensory overload and total bombardment. Like, I couldn't go all the way negative. There's just enough about it that makes it okay. But by
comparison, better than Transformers 3.
It's better than Transformers 3, exactly. But by comparison, I mean, I think that it stands up so much better as an example of, if there is a Michael Bay formula, it's not Avengers, it's Battleship, you know. So, anyway, that's Battleship. So now let's talk about Avengers, Trey.
Did Battleship make you feel dirty?
No.
Okay.
No.
Oh, okay.
That's
the
difference between a minor rock fist down and a rock fist way down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it whether you feel dirty or not?
See, I walk out of a minor down, I'm like, oh, man, I wasted my time, but whatever. And I walk out of bad movies, and I just want to punch a hole in a wall.
You're just angry.
Right.
That they ruined movies for you for that day.
Right.
So Avengers for Trey.
Well, no.
Minor
well,
rock fist down. Right.
Minor rock fist down. But,
okay.
But in kind of getting back into this conversation. Or I guess, you know, for me to get into this conversation with you guys, I have been thinking a lot about, because, yes, I gave this a minor rock fist down, and I have been considering that, and I wouldn't say, I was never not resolute about that choice.
You were clearly affected when you walked
out. Yeah, when you walked out, you were not happy.
But the more I think about it, just the more completely comfortable I am with that assessment. And I've been thinking a lot about what summer movies have been sort of historically since the advent of the big summer blockbuster.
Since Jaws.
In the late 70s, mid to late 70s.
Right.
And then what they have become recently. And I think that, you know, if I'm going to be completely honest, I think the Avengers is a relatively good example of what a contemporary blockbuster does.
It's part of the problem and not the solution.
Exactly. And that what blockbusters could do historically was something exciting, something really fun, something that could stick with you for multiple years.
Like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Exactly. Raiders of the Lost Ark is the example of an awesome blockbuster.
Yeah.
But even when, you know, at the point when anything becomes a franchise, that's a part of the problem. So I would say even as far back as Temple of Doom, you could say that's the first step in what is, you know, what summer blockbusters would eventually become. And that's the thing, is that I am comfortable with my minor rock fist down, and I, with my minor rock fist down, because I was thinking about the blockbusters last summer. So you've got Thor, you've got Transformers 3, you've got Captain America, and there were some okay. I mean, I liked Thor.
Green Lantern.
But I walked out of Thor, and I was like, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
And I walked out of Captain America and said, yeah, that was fun.
Right.
But you know what? I don't find any compelling reason to go back and revisit those films at all. I know exactly what I got with them. And you know what? I'm going to get it next year also. And there's no compelling reason. It doesn't challenge me in any way, shape, or form. And that's the thing, is that a film like Raiders was fun, It had awesome special effects, great action sequences, and yet there was enough to it that it challenges you in some way. And I know Raiders is a high water mark, and not a whole lot of things are gonna hold up to it. Sure. But in listening to the podcast from last week, I just felt like the sort of overwhelming praise and the only minor asides to it's formulaic that you guys gave to this film made this sound like a high water mark of summer blockbusters. And I only think that is true if you are saying that it is a high watermark of summer blockbusters
recent.
As far as contemporary summer blockbusters, which is sad.
Yeah.
That's like saying, Two and a Half Men is the best sitcom on TV right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the highest rated sitcom. It's awful.
Yeah.
And so,
what about a summer blockbuster like Star Trek?
I think Star Trek was in some ways a return to what summer blockbusters, because I have gone back and revisited Star Trek, and it does hold up pretty well.
Yeah.
But it was a total re-envisioning of a former franchise, and it took great liberties with those characters and with those plot lines, and it made something that was unique and interesting, and it did it in a vibrant, compelling way. And Avengers doesn't do that at all.
Okay, well, I've got about 8 minutes, so let me say my piece, and then we'll let Trevin talk. So basically, I saw the Avengers again this last weekend. I saw it in 2D this time, and on a smaller screen. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that I pointed out, I believe I said more than what you gave us credit for in the negative department, but maybe I didn't, about the opening of the film and the first 45 minutes and kind of the clunky exposition that they had to get out of the way. I noticed more of that the second time out. And I will have to say that the excitement of these characters coming together and fighting, and fighting when they first meet and then eventually coming together, and that whole process that was so exciting and so awesome the first time out, a little less exciting and a little less awesome the second time out. And then the action scene at the end, still, I think, an exemplary example of a movie that has clearly defined goals and objectives and then lays them out so that you can see what's going on and has character building throughout, was just a little less exciting as well the second time. But I still think that it is a really good example of a blockbuster. I think that the first 45 minutes of the film was basically Joss Whedon saying, you've seen all these other movies. I've got to get this one going. I don't have an origin story, but I do have this to get out of the way. And so the idea that you said about a movie being a franchise being part of the problem, I would 100% agree with.
Yeah.
Because there are things that these Marvel movies have to do, and these lines that they have to follow. And I think Whedon did the best job out of anybody in all of the Marvel movies up to this point of getting those out of the way and then moving on to making the movie that he wanted to make. Now, that said, he did more character building in this movie with Scarlett Johansson's character than there was in Iron Man 2. He made Agent Coulson a character that we could actually care about. There's more character building on him. There's more subtle moments in this movie that make us care about the characters than many of the movies that came before them.
And
I think that those character arcs, he did a really great job of fleshing out. And that was the other thing that I noticed the second time. So, there's more dumb exposition about what the Tesseract is and all the Loki stuff. And again, I don't think that Loki was as effective as in this movie as he was in Thor, because his role was a lot smaller and less backstory. But I still think Whedon did an incredible job wrangling all this and making a movie that you can get excited about at the end. I'm admitting more faults to the film. I'm happy that I gave it a solid rock fist up. But the second time I saw it, it fell down a couple pegs in my personal list of the best superhero movies ever made.
Well, I'll respond to that, and then Trevin and I can have a long and detailed conversation. But, I think that as far as the characters go, a lot of people are like, oh, hey, these characters are so well handled. But I still assert that Iron Man is a series of like one-liners. It's, you know, it's
Iron
Legolas.
Man and the Avengers.
Iron Man in the Avengers.
Oh, okay, sure.
In the or so Tony Stark in the Avengers. Series of just one-liners. Point Break, Legolas. I mean, it was just every single person had one. And that was the way we develop his character. And then he keeps poking Bruce Banner with...
His character's already developed. That's the interesting thing about this film, is that we have to consider the movies that came before it.
We do have to concede that we've got stuff that came before. But it is a regression. I think it's a regression. Because that's the thing, is that we have a character that has gone through this arc, and now it's a regression to just make him a series of one-liners. Which, other than a conversation with Bruce Banner in the lab, that's all we've got of Tony Stark.
Well, that's not true. He has the
same... and he's got the terrible line that he delivers to Captain America when Captain America says, oh, so you lost a man soldier? I'm not a soldier. And that's the thing. I'm not a soldier, and they're going to come back because we're going to need them are two awful lines.
Oh, no,
awful
no.
No.
I completely disagree about
because
that.
Because we're going to need them?
Yeah.
That's a terrible line.
That's what comic books...
That is unforgivably bad.
No, it's not. No. I think it's completely in the genre of the superhero movie. It's just like when they put the bat signal up and the camera's panning out and somebody says, you know, he'll be there when we need him. It's the same thing. It's part of the genre.
Oh, man. I mean, for as much as you want to, like, applaud Whedon at his ability to write dialogue and stuff, and I think he can... He could have given us a better line.
Oh, I disagree. And by the way, Captain America in this movie?
Clapping himself in the chains of Comic-Con,
I don't think so. I don't think so. And Captain America in this movie, who is the cheesiest character around, has some perfect lines. Whedon understands the way this guy's going to think.
Oh, I thought Captain America worked
he's a
pretty effectively.
And it's awesome. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then he has his moment
But here's the thing, is that we never, like, he starts to complicate Captain America, but we never really follow through on that because Captain America sees that, oh, these are the same weapons that Hydra was developing.
Yeah.
But that's the end of the complication.
What more do you need?
That's the thing. Is
that's his character arc. He starts here and ends there.
That's not an arc. That's an end. That's a, oh, hey, I'm becoming more complex, and now we'll stop.
Well, I don't know.
And that's the thing. That is what I'm saying is I'm conceding that these are the limitations of not only this particular genre, but Joss Whedon has Marvel over his shoulder going, you can do this, you can't do that, you can do this. I mean, it's really like Joss Whedon was hired to make a commercial, and he's got the client who owns the company that the commercial is being made for over his shoulder telling him what he can and can't do.
I think he improved several of the characters in this movie, with the exception of maybe Thor and the fact that Iron Man...
I would disagree with that even. Thor has a great, like, grown-up sequence at the very beginning when he talks to Loki and talks about what it's like to lead and that he doesn't understand the point of true power and all that. I mean, that represents a total character change from what he was in the first movie. So, I don't know. I think that he did a pretty...
I think he did as good a job as he can.
And that's what I said. You know, Eric and I both said that, but I think, you know, I think it stands out, you know, as a blockbuster by today's standards, sure, but, you know, no other movie has had this kind of ambition or had this much to do. You know what I mean? In terms of it ties together
maybe, but
five franchises.
Five. Yeah, you know? And that's exactly it, is that it's just like this much to do is one thing to say, but it's like saying...
But it doesn't successfully is what I'm saying. Like, you know, there was a lot to make this work, and I know that, you know, it's Disney-owned and so there's plenty of cross promotion. I mean, anyone who goes into this and doesn't see it as a product, you know, just doesn't understand the business at all. And that's fine. I mean, maybe if you can go into a movie and not think of it in terms in those kind of dollar and cents terms, you'll get a different level of enjoyment out of it. But just knowing that this movie's a launch pad for the next at least 5 years of franchises, that it incorporated the last six movies, counting Iron Man 1 and 2. To like take the plots and keep the character developments from the previous movies and not just throw them out because I needed to tell a specific story here, but to actually continue with character development from the previous films they've each had. you know, those are pretty significant accomplishments to me.
I mean,
you know,
does
the "we are not soldiers" line, you know, like I thought that line was bad.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm totally in cahoots with you on that. You know, but overall, I really have a hard time saying bad things about it because they're like compared to Battleship, you know, like you'd compared Avengers a little bit to a Michael Bay movie when we did our video review.
Sure,
Michael Bay,
sure.
You trained him well, you know. And watching Battleship in comparison, it's like these characters are totally interchangeable. There's no one here that has any sort of definition, and they're coming from, you know, stage one. Like, this is the launch pad of this franchise, and I don't care about anyone or anything. There's nothing here that makes me beholden to any of it. It's just a series of shots with a predictable story arc and ending, and a lot of explosion effects and Brooklyn Decker in a tight top in two scenes. And then, you know, you look at Avengers, and, like, we all know how that movie's going to end. They're going to come together, and they're going to save the day.
And
there's at least a few scenes along the way that give you insight into some characters. There are some scenes where you like... And then the
Michael Bay comment is specifically in terms of the visual style.
Right.
Because here's the thing, is that Joss Whedon is first and foremost a writer.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And
this is only the second movie he's ever directed. Yeah,
his directing, I think his biggest flaw is that he has no specific directing style.
Right.
He has no specific visual style.
Yeah.
And I can say that with absolute earnestness because a student of mine just did a critical breakdown of Dr. Horrible.
Yeah.
And thinking that she was going to find more to it, like, and be able to analyze it visually.
Right.
And it's just a mishmash of nothing. You know, there's
right.
no distinct visual style. And so Joss Whedon is first and foremost a writer. He's good at embedding his characters with a decent amount of detail with a short amount of time. You know, and he's a writer of television.
Right.
And so a writer of television, given 90 minutes, that's a luxury because typically you get anywhere from 45 to 22, you know, 22 to 45 minutes of actual groundwork over the course of an episode.
Sure.
You know, he's also somebody who works well in episodics. So he can come, you know, to a project after it has been developed over five other projects.
Sure.
And work well within that. So, but he's first and foremost a writer. Mm. And he has no distinct visual style. And I think he basically, at times, lifted Michael Bay's. So it is not in any way a slam on him as far as his characters.
Sure.
Who I think, at the very least, are distinct from one another.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think there is the level of character development that you and Eric give it credit for.
Right.
But I think that he does keep them distinct in their roles and makes them necessary to what they individually are, but it is absolutely a comment on the visual side.
Right.
The lens flares, the big
the
circular
spin.
Tracking shots, those big battle moments that start to slow down, and we're supposed to feel something because this is slow-mo, and there are chunks of concrete blowing through the background as these characters cower or whatever.
Right.
But there's also the same level of inconsistency within the action scenes, where a character can jump from a moving helicopter and land safely with a roll or two, but then gets knocked out with a couple of swift punches.
Right.
So that's the thing there. But Whedon has always been inconsistent in his own visual style. So I mean, that's something he's never had.
Right.
So it's not a slam on him. It's just pointing out a fact. From Buffy to Angel to Serenity to you know, Firefly to whatever, he's never had a consistent visual style.
Yeah.
But
you know, for me, I still consider the movie a major success, and I've seen it three times, and you know, it really, I'm just totally on board.
Yeah.
Every time, and you know, Eric complained about the opening and how the first 45 minutes are kind of rocky. You know, I don't even agree with that. Like, that doesn't bother me at all. The whole setup and everything. It's a little Lord of the Rings-ish at the very beginning when it's like the Tesseract and explains what it is and the weird alien army and all that kind of stuff. Like, it feels, you know, the main thing is if you're a fan of Whedon's work, which, you know, I admittedly came to late, you know, and I've not watched every season of Buffy. I've only watched, you know, Firefly and Serenity, and then got really into his comic book work, you know, and that's kind of where I say I'm not going to touch Dollhouse with a 10-foot pole.
Sure.
You know, I might go through Buffy at some point, but, you know, I'm not in a hurry to. But, you know, if you are one of those people that have gone through every season of Buffy and Firefly and Serenity and his comic book work and Dollhouse, like, if you're a total Whedonite, you know, this movie is going to seem very familiar in a lot of ways, you know. And that's, you know, that's like saying, well, you know, Scorsese's crime movies are similar. You know, like, it's a genre. There's certain tropes that are just kind of present because that's what the writer or what the director, that's what they put their stamp on.
But at the same time, I think Cabin in the Woods is much more, like, I think Cabin in the Woods is much more near and dear.
Yeah.
Would be more near and dear to a Whedonite's heart than the Avengers.
Yeah, sure. Avengers, you know, like, he's working with existing characters. There's not nearly as much self-reference. Really, the only self-reference is the Iron Man stuff, you know, like the one-liners you were complaining about earlier. Like, that's one of the only points of self-referential dialogue in the entire movie that comes up. But, you know, like, you've got... I liked a lot of the things that it did. You know, it's not the giant, you know, patriotic eyesore that Battleship or that the Transformers movies are. You know, the government's actually kind of an enemy at one point.
Sure.
You know, you've got some like distrust in the government and in Big Brother. I thought the weaponization, like, that whole plot line, I thought that was a brilliant stroke. And it made sense within the overall narrative that, like, yeah, we would weaponize to try and arm ourselves against these other worldly beings, you know, like...
Sure.
He managed to tie a lot of threads together that in
but
ways...
But he didn't tie that thread up. It's never fully resolved.
No, I mean, like, it basically gets put on the back burner while they have to deal with New York get attacked.
Yeah.
You know,
and
like,
they may address that in future movies.
Right.
It might have exactly been the intent.
Right. It's hard to tell at this point, but yeah, it does kind of go by the wayside. You know, there's something that kind of interrupts the discussion about it, and they move on.
That's part of the restraint that a huge company of like Marvel that has been working towards this film for so long places on a director. So in some ways, it's just like Whedon could have written this, and anybody could have phoned in this directing.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that. I wouldn't disagree with that.
But to me, I think that's sad. I think that's sad because there was a time when this type of film could have been visually distinct, told cinematically, told visually, been exciting throughout. It could have excited the highbrow and the lowbrow.
Right.
And I think right now this is – I don't think this film speaks to the lowest common denominator.
Right.
But it's somewhere in the middle. It's definitely not. It's definitely not there to satisfy – you know, the true cinematic aficionados.
Sure.
It is there to appease the roller coaster fanatic filmgoers.
Yeah.
It is much like a Jurassic Park, where it's like once you have seen the ride, it is going to be less successful. Even if you still enjoy it, it will be less successful the second time.
Just knowing what's coming. Yeah, that sort of
goes down. You know, to me, it's just... It is what contemporary film, the summer blockbusters has become, and whether you think it's the most successful of those or not, you know, I think that I've got to personally make a choice that I am not equipped to successfully review these films on the terms that they want to exist on, because their ambitions are not high minded. They're not, and summer blockbusters used to embrace the B movie critically, which I think is what Jaws does. It is a B movie. Jaws is totally a B movie, but it's a smart B movie. It's an interesting B movie. It's a complex B movie, and I don't think you can do that anymore.
Wow, that was an interesting little speech to come in on the end of.
Yeah.
So Avengers is not smart or interesting.
I mean, I think it's as smart as it can be. But I think
I agree.
I think it's under too many constraints to be really legitimately smart.
I disagree. Really, I think it's the best of the Marvel films so far, with the exception of maybe Iron Man, which I'm going to have to watch again because I haven't seen in years.
I think that's setting the bar really low.
Iron Man is my fourth favorite superhero movie of all time.
Avengers is my first now. I mean,
really?
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, no way.
You said it the first night. Don't do that. You said it your first night.
It might be.
No, you said this is the most fun I've had since Spider-Man 2 and that thing.
Spider-Man 2 is your first?
Absolutely.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean,
this is insane. I missed some good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think our dedication and devotion to comic book movies, which constrain us. They constrain us, you know, and I think it's sad because it's like, to me, it would be exciting to continually re-envision these characters, which are, you know, our modern contemporary, you know, hero tropes. Spider-Man should be something different every single time, you know, every single time. Well, he should have at its core, I mean, that sort of, you know, great power comes great responsibility. But you could do insane things with that.
Did you see Chronicle?
Yeah.
Chronicle are new heroes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Did you like it?
I didn't see Chronicle.
Oh, you've got to see it.
I know I do. But it's new heroes, and I think that's great. New heroes you can do whatever you want with, because you're not constrained by, like, people walking out going, well, that wasn't a Spider-Man movie in a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is Spider-Man is a fictional metaphor for what human beings in a specific state are. So Spider-Man should be re-envisioned and re-envisioned and re-envisioned.
Well, maybe it will be. We haven't seen the new one
and
yet.
Hulk,
who knows?
As long as it's a conflict between the passionate, aggressive desires that we all have and the logic centers that we all have, Hulk, beyond that, should be able to be anything.
But you're describing what happens in comic books.
Exactly.
I mean, that's exactly.
And that's why I'm saying that within the movie, these things should be capable of being.
They're
going to
hit a point where they can't do it anymore. And they'll get rebooted. I mean, like, it might not be in the next 5 years, but they'll get.
I thought the Hulk was very re-envisioned in this movie.
Yeah.
This is the first time we've seen this kind of treatment with the Hulk. I thought it was really successful.
Because I'm always angry. Again, that was
That was a
shitty line.
That was a development. That was a part of a plot development.
But it was a shitty line.
Oh, I thought it was a great line. Because what it did is it gave us a moment where we had to consider there's something about this character that we didn't know. This is a hint, right? It's a teaser of what's to come. Because they needed to find a way for the Hulk to be able to semi-control, turn it on and turn it off in order to become part of this team. He's still, even when he's on, he's still not really a team player. Right, he punches Thor in the middle of battle because he's still pissed off about
the
last. Right, but I think that one line again. I don't think you're giving Whedon enough credit for making these big time character developments with little tiny subtle lines. It's what Bryan Singer did so well in X2. So, and I think
it's what David
Hayter
did
really well.
So well in X2.
Well, whoever you want to credit it to,
Bryan Singer didn't have shit to do with that script.
Yeah. I just. You know, again, I think
those are the types of things
that he's totally constrained to do. I think that's his constraint.
He's very
I would agree with you, except the movies I can think of recently that don't follow this or that do kind of create their own, like the blockbusters that have kind of reinvented things or told original stories, you've hated, like Inception. You know, like
Inception to me is a heist film. It follows the heist film formula.
So?
But I mean, that's the thing. It's a heist film that's also built in a sort of glass house, in this crystalline, delicate world that has to be over-explained and ultimately falls apart, is its own worst enemy, instead of just making a kick-ass heist film.
I'm saying that Avengers doesn't work because it's got the burden of expectations and previous stories
and characters that exist. I mean, you can make a unique and terrible film. It's possible to do both. I'm just saying that I feel like summer blockbusters don't have... And Inception had a level of ambition. I feel like Nolan
is totally
overrated.
Yeah.
Just overall.
Right.
So, I mean, that's... you're picking a director that I already am skeptical of fundamentally.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Right. We should wrap it up. I mean, we should wrap it up. But, you know, I do think...
I'm glad you've been able to say your piece. I know it wasn't really fair for us to talk about
it
last
week. No, it's fine. I mean,
you
guys need to. So. But, you know, after listening to the auditory sounds of you guys sucking Whedon's dick for too long, I just had to get in my piece. And I think you guys make some really compelling comments and defense of this being the best of the blockbusters. My addendum to that would be this is the best of the blockbusters right now, and to me, I think it's a sad state of blockbusters now. And
I think it's interesting the level of emotional investment that each of us has in this. Trey is happy to get his point across and has no emotional investment in the Avengers. I enjoyed the film, and I'm having a good time listening to him. Trevin is over here. Everything about his physical appearance is like, you know, the Hulk. He's ready to explode.
Sure.
He's just it's so funny how much emotional investment we put into these movies and these characters. And then through the rest of the year, we are talking about all these serious films with, you know, more interesting themes and that take more chances, and we get passionate about those. But there is something to be said about these characters who we've grown up with. And, you know, I mean, it's the same reason that Star Wars is still something for kids our age.
Sure.
So, yeah, I just wanted to point that out. It's interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, maybe we'll talk about Avengers again next week.
Let's never talk about it. Yeah. I mean, seriously, it's like I'll can it and go out there and watch Avengers. It's fun and you'll love it. And I'm one of three people who isn't going to like
it. For Trey, it seems like this is the straw that broke the camel's back. You've been thinking about this for a while, and finally, just over the top, it just broke. You're like, you know, I'm done.
Yeah. I'm just going to be done with these types of films, and that's fine.
Which is why I was glad that you didn't go to Battleship.
Oh God. Yeah. That would have been awful.
I mean, and I totally understand. It's just like,
I mean, it wasn't a good movie, but I can still sit through it because I can just be like, oh wow, that sucks. You know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I'm not physically hurt by it. Like you are.
Yeah. I mean, I crave September.
Yeah.
All right. We'll let it go.
All right.
Bye.